Chapter 2, Questions and Answers. Question: what is the symbolical significance of the name White Lotus Sutra? Does the title relate to the content of the sutra? Most translators call it simply the Lotus Sutra. Is this inexactitude? Answer: when you take the full title, Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, the emphasis needs to be on Saddharma. It's not just the Dharma, but the real Dharma, the true Dharma, because it contains a higher revelation in respect to the unity of the three yanas and in respect of the eternity of the Buddha. I wouldn't like to say that calling it the White Lotus of the true Dharma was just a flowery addition, but Indian Buddhists were very fond of that kind of style. There's also the Karuna Pundarika Sutra, the White Lotus of Compassion Sutra. You can look at the symbolism of the lotus, that it blooms, that it grows out of the mud, and so on, but that can really be applied to any sutra, because any sutra represents the transcendental truth in that kind of way. So although no doubt you could give an exegesis of the title in such a way as to demonstrate the whole teaching of the sutra, in my view that would not originally have been intended to be the case. As I say, the emphasis should really be on the fact that the sutra embodies the Saddharma, the real teaching of the Buddha. The White Lotus just makes the title more pleasing and evocative. Strictly speaking, Pundarika is White Lotus, just as Utpala is Blue Lotus. But sometimes Pundarika is used simply to mean lotus. I have seen these lotuses growing in India. They are white, tinged with pink, bigger than a water lily, and their petals are large and slightly blousy, not spiky like the petals of water lilies. Question: the sutra is often called the Threefold Lotus Sutra. What relationship do the preceding and succeeding sutras bear to the White Lotus Sutra? Answer: they are apparently apocryphal works of Chinese composition. They have their own value. Some of the imagery in the introductory sutra is quite extraordinary. But in a way they are superfluous, because the White Lotus Sutra stands complete in itself and needs no introduction or conclusion. I've not worked out any doctrinal connection, but no doubt that could be done, or has been done. Question: you call these two sutras apocryphal, but isn't any Mahayana text claiming its descent from the Buddha through some revelation apocryphal? Answer: Chinese works such as these are apocryphal in that they purport to be translated from Sanskrit and have an array of names of translators, dates and places of translation. But these details amount to deception, for the works are not in fact translations at all. This distinguishes them from Mahayana sutras, which are apocryphal in the Indian sense. Unlike the Indians, the Chinese had a highly developed critical sense, which they applied to their own literature and to Buddhist works, so they would have been aware of stylistic differences, and that certain words come into use at a certain time. They had a sophisticated ability to discriminate in this way, which did not become common in Europe until after the Renaissance. Question: in the Eternal Legacy, you say that the Mahayana Sutras are revealed, directly or indirectly, by the Buddha's Sambhogakaya, Body of Glory, and you also say that we are not to think of the sutras as necessarily being delivered at some one particular time and place. Were the sutras composed by enlightened disciples, or do we have to believe that a germ of them, at least, was uttered by the historical Buddha? Answer: well, we cannot regard the Mahayana Sutras in their present form as having been delivered by the historical Buddha Shakyamuni. It may well be, however, that some of the teachings contained in the sutras do go back to Shakyamuni, and perhaps even some of his actual words are embedded in them. This is noticeable in, for example, the Lalita Vistara, in which quite extensive passages of what would seem to be the teaching of the historical Buddha are embedded in this very colourful Mahayana Sutra. The difference in style and approach can be seen very easily, because the quotations are in rather sober vein, whereas the rest of the text is highly mythic and poetic. Although there are examples like this, however, as a whole the sutras cannot possibly be regarded as representing the actual discourses of the historical Buddha. So what was the genesis of the Mahayana Sutras? If they were not the utterance of the historical Buddha, whose utterance were they? Certainly they purport to be the utterance of the historical Buddha, though saying that raises all sorts of questions, because the ancient Buddhists did not distinguish the historical from the non-historical, so they would not have been able to think of a sutra as having been given by a non-historical as distinct from a historical Buddha. They just did not use those categories. But from our point of view, where did those sutras originate? If the sutras are communication from the enlightened mind, as they appear to be, no less than the Pali scriptures, we can only assume that certain gifted disciples had experiences of communication from the Buddha in the sense of the trans-historical essence of Buddhahood. They would then have written down this communication as best they understood it, in the form of the Mahayana Sutras, attributing those sutras in all sincerity to the Buddha himself. It is not that they were deliberately composing something of their own, which they proceeded to put into the mouth of the Buddha. That would have been entirely foreign to their way of thinking. Perhaps there were different levels of inspiration, so that sometimes what purported to be the utterance of the Sambhogakaya actually sprang from a rather lower level of inspiration. But in the case of some Mahayana sutras, we cannot resist the impression that, as far as we are able to judge, they sprang from as high a level of inspiration as we encounter in the Pali Canon, with respect to utterances which seem to be those of the historical Buddha. So it would seem that the Mahayana Sutras, broadly speaking, originated in the spiritual experience of spiritually gifted disciples, who were able to reach a level corresponding to that of the Buddha's own spiritual attainment, and received there, so to speak, a communication from the Buddha, which they thereafter embodied, perhaps sometimes in their own language, in what we know as the Mahayana Sutras. Question. So the sutras were esoteric, non-public writings composed by enlightened disciples? Answer. The impression I have is not that they were withheld from ordinary people or other members of the spiritual community any more than the Hinayana Sutras were. You must remember that many of the Mahayana Sutras were produced at a period when writing had become much more common than it was in the Buddha's day. The sutras were committed to writing, or perhaps even originally composed in written form. They do not bear the hallmarks of oral traditions as the Pali Suttas do. This means that they would automatically have had a wider circulation than was possible for a teaching that was transmitted orally and had to be learned from the lips of a teacher with whom you were in personal contact. Many Mahayana sutras have colophons extolling the virtues of copying and distributing the sutra, which would suggest that Mahayana sutras were definitely not thought of as esoteric documents in the way that the Vinaya was. According to the Vinaya, it is an offence to teach the Dharma to one who is not a bhikkhu. But the Mahayana Sutras issue no such prohibition. In fact, you are encouraged to transmit the sutra to as many sentient beings as possible, an attitude which is, of course, in accordance with the Bodhisattva ideal. Question. But the White Lotus Sutra does emphasize the dire consequences of disparaging the sutra. The Buddha goes so far as to say, "Those who slander this sutra, if I told a tale of their evils, I could not exhaust them in a whole kalpa. For this cause and reason, I especially say to you, amongst undiscerning people, do not preach this sutra." Presumably not preaching the sutra to the undiscerning
would save them from the consequences of hearing it, yet being unreceptive to it, or even disparaging it. The implication is that it is better not to hear the Dharma at all than to hear it and react against it. Is this so? If it is, should all forms of transmission of the Dharma be given only to those likely to be receptive, rather than being given indiscriminately in the form of books, public talks, and so on? Answer. We can't take such an extreme warning at face value. This kind of statement appears in Mahayana Sutras for a mixture of reasons. Mahayana Sutras were not accepted by Hinayanists, to use that term, as genuine Buddha Vachana, and sometimes the Hinayanists seem to have criticized the sutras, or even slandered them, as the Mahayanists would see it. The warnings of this kind, which the Mahayana Sutras contain, are therefore partly polemical in intent. At the same time, they are partly the expression of a genuine concern for people's spiritual well-being, a concern that people should not be put in a position of rejecting something which it can only do them harm to reject. You have to be very careful about this. It is not as though there is some avenging deity waiting to punish you. If you are not receptive to the truth, however, or if you get into the habit of closing your mind to something which you cannot immediately accept and understand, you do come to be in a powerless condition, spiritually speaking. The Mahayana Sutras are really saying that it is not skillful to present a pupil with teachings which, given their general attitude and mental makeup, they cannot but reject. If those teachings bear the label Buddhism, they can only come to the conclusion that Buddhism is not for them. People should not be fed teachings in such quantities that they are quite unable to digest them and are bound to vomit them up. On the other hand, you also need to be careful in another way. In the 19th century, there was a great controversy in the church between the Anglicans and the Roman Catholics. A Catholic priest produced a pamphlet called Reserve in Communicating Religious Knowledge, which suggested that if, for instance, someone who was interested in Catholicism came round to see a priest, the priest should not talk about Catholic dogmas like the infallibility of the Pope all at once, because that would be bound to put the visitor off. The advice was that the priest should say first the kind of thing that the visitor would be able to accept more readily, such as that the Catholic Church teaches that we should love our enemies. The other doctrines or dogmas should be kept in reserve, in recognition of the fact that they were not very acceptable to someone who was just beginning to be interested in the Catholic Church. When the Anglicans got hold of this pamphlet, of course, they at once accused the Catholic Church of hypocrisy, of not being open with people about its true beliefs. In a way, though, the Catholic priests had a point. If you try to explain certain things to people before they are prepared, you may simply scare them away. The fact is that people progress very slowly on the spiritual path, and at the beginning they are just not prepared for the teachings pertaining to the latter stages of the path. On the other hand, there is also something in the accusation of hypocrisy. You could use this reserve in communicating religious knowledge in a way that was not quite honest and straightforward. So this is a matter of some tact and delicacy. For instance, suppose someone at a meditation class asked you, "Do Buddhists not believe in God?" If you replied, "Oh no, lots of Buddhists believe in God," that would not be straightforward and honest. But suppose you knew that if you were to say that Buddhists do not believe in God, full stop, then that person would never come to the class again. How should you reply? It is a difficult question. I suggest that you should temporize, using that word positively. You could say, for example, the word God can be understood in a number of different ways. Nowadays, there is a lot of discussion, even among Christians, as to what God really means, even as to whether there is a God. In Buddhism, we do not pronounce very readily about matters concerning ultimate reality, and from the Christian point of view, God is a statement of ultimate reality. We prefer to concentrate on the actual practice of ethics and meditation, with a view to eventually having a deeper understanding of these things for ourselves out of our personal experience. If you were to answer in this way, you would be neither hypocritical nor untrue to the Buddhist tradition. Sometimes people want to corner you and force you to make a statement one way or the other, but you should not allow this to happen. Sometimes you have to say, Buddhism is a vast subject. It's not easy, even for those who have been practicing it for some time, to understand it. Just take it bit by bit. Concentrate on observing the precepts, practicing meditation, and reflecting on whatever teachings appeal to you most. Leave the others aside if you find them too difficult or unacceptable. We would not insist that you sign the 39 articles of Buddhism on the spot, even if we had them. Question. You said that the White Lotus Sutra may have been written down in Central Asia. How much Central Asian influence is evident in the sutra, in terms of its cosmology or even its spiritual content? Answer. The question is perhaps better applied to Mahayana sutras in general than specifically to the White Lotus Sutra. It has been suggested that Mahayana imagery, particularly the concept of Amitabha and the Pure Land of the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutras, does owe something to Iranian influences. There are anticipations of the dual trees in the Pure Land in the Digha Nikaya of the Pali Canon, for example. And it would seem likely that this idea of dual trees in magnificent gardens is of Babylonian origin. We know that Ashoka was in contact with the Persian Empire, and Persian artisans apparently came to India to build his palace, which seems to have been modelled on that of Persepolis, for those highly polished columns can only have been produced by Persian craftsmen. So it seems quite possible that some of the later, more legendary sutras in the Digha Nikaya, belonging to that period, 100 years after the Buddha, do reflect the Persian influence in their imagery. Question. You have referred to the Mahayana sutras as works of symbolic religious art, and recommended that we should see them as giving us a glimpse into an archetypal world, rather than providing an actual pattern of Buddhist living. So, what is the best approach to studying this non-conceptual material? Answer. It is very difficult to say. The main thing is to avoid literalism. You should familiarize yourself with the letter of the text, but not take it too literally. Many people approach almost any Buddhist material in a very literalistic way, grasping the letter tightly and often missing the spirit completely. I'm afraid I will be misunderstood, but I would almost advise that you should not take it too seriously. Read it in the way that you would read good poetry or a good novel. Enjoy it. Immerse yourself in it. You can get down to a study of what the details mean and what the deeper significance of the sutra might be later on. To begin with, it is very important to allow the work as a whole to have some impact on you, to try to experience it as a whole rather than getting lost in the details. It is also important to read the sutra itself and use a commentary to throw light on it rather than the other way around. Question. The White Lotus Sutra seems to consist of two main revelations, that there is in truth only one spiritual path, and that what we perceive as the historical Buddha is really an expression of eternal enlightenment. Chapters 1 to 10 seem to be an independent drama, providing a setting for and an application of the first revelation. Chapters 11, 15 and 16 then provide a setting for the second revelation. Do you think there might originally have been two independent teachings which were brought together to form the twin nuclei of the White Lotus Sutra? Answer. Leaving aside the miscellaneous cluster of chapters at the end, the sutra does naturally fall into these two parts, but that is no reason to regard them as having been originally independent works. Although they have their distinctive themes, the two sections do seem to hang together. One corresponds to the relative bodhicitta, and the other to the absolute bodhicitta. One is concerned with the spiritual path which exists in time and is followed in time, and the other pertains to ultimate reality, as embodied in the Buddha, which exists outside space and time. I do not have an impression of discontinuity of two independent sutras having been soldered together to make a single work, and as far as I know, this has not been suggested by any scholar who has made a study of the work. I think you are correct in detecting the difference in theme between the two sections, but that distinction represents the basic structure of the sutra and conveys its twofold message. Question. The sutra talks of faith as the emotional equivalent of wisdom, and recommends worship of the sutra as a practice. Some Buddhists seem to see homage to the White Lotus Sutra as their only practice. Could this ever be a full path to enlightenment? Answer. I suppose it depends what you mean by worship of the White Lotus Sutra. I think that true worship of the sutra could at least be an approach to the path to enlightenment. But I'm not sure how easily worship of a text would come to people in the West. It is not impossible, but it is a little foreign to our tradition. Text worship does feature prominently in some religions, particularly Sikhism. Sikhism has no images, but has as the object of worship the Adi Granth, which they call the Guru Granth, the volume of the Sikh scriptures. Sikhs place a beautifully printed volume of this text on a silken cushion or on a canopied throne, and they make offerings to it, just as described in the Mahayana Sutras, where the practice probably originated. You could adopt the practice of keeping a scripture open on the shrine, with a little glass case to protect it from incense smoke. It would be suitable for Dharma Day in particular, but it would be appropriate at all times if you wanted to represent all of the three jewels in the shrine room. The symbol of the Buddha jewel is the image. The symbol of the Sangha jewel is the presence of the spiritual community. But to symbolize the Dharma jewel, a book is needed. Question. Nichiren, of course, teaches the practice of reverence for the sutra. Notes on Nichiren. Nichiren, the founder of the Japanese sect bearing his name, lived in the 13th century CE. One of his three principal teachings, the Three Great Secrets, was the wonderful truth of the Lotus Sutra. He termed the mantra Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, homage to the Lotus of the Good Law, a summation of the Lotus Sutra, and his followers adopted the incantation. Today there are almost 40 subsects of Nichiren's adherents, chief of which is the Nichiren Shoshu. Nichiren, of course, teaches the practice of reverence for the sutra. It seems almost like a form of Pure Land Buddhism, with devotion offered to the White Lotus Sutra rather than to Amitabha. Could this practice actually lead the practitioner to an insight into the sutra? Answer. The standard Buddhist teaching is that the five spiritual faculties, which include faith, must be balanced. For a time, one particular faculty may predominate, but in the end, they need to be in equilibrium. As I see it, there is no question of alternative paths, as is sometimes suggested in Hinduism. If you start off travelling the path of devotion, sooner or later you have to bring in the path of wisdom. The one reinforces the other. Question. In the sutra, the Buddha explains to the assembly that the truth is very difficult to understand and has to be approached gradually. Do you accept the Mahayana suggestion that its teachings are more profound than those that historically precede it? Are the Heart Sutra and the White Lotus Sutra more profound than the teachings of the Pali Canon? Answer. That is a very difficult question. Who is to judge what is profound? Someone studying a verse of the Dhammapada, for example, might see the whole truth in that, even though others could not. Sometimes the implications of an apparently simple saying are absolutely vast. Perhaps you might say that some texts or sayings are more obviously more profound than others, but it is very difficult to make a blanket statement. Certainly, some Mahayana teachings are more elaborate than others. For instance, the Mahayana Sutras have gone into the Shunyata teaching in a much more thoroughgoing fashion than any Pali text. Perhaps you need some acquaintance with the Mahayana to be able to appreciate the depths of some of the Buddha's teaching in the Pali scriptures. The depths may be there, but for various reasons it is not so well articulated. The linguistic resources of the Mahayana were far greater, because a Buddhist vocabulary had been developed and refined by that time, and confusions had been resolved. The Buddha had to make do with the language used by the people around him who did not have his enlightenment experience. He had to use the same language, but try to use it in his own way. When the Mahayana Sutras were composed hundreds of years later, Buddhists had developed a language of their own which was more adequate to express their insights and intuitions. Question. So you would not accept the sutra's suggestion that it is explicating a fuller teaching? Answer. It is fuller in relation to the classical Hinayana, but the classical Hinayana does not necessarily coincide with certain teachings of the historical Buddha as recorded in the existing Pali Canon. Assuming that the teachings of the Pali Canon are properly understood, it could not be said that the Mahayana goes beyond them. Question. How radical would the idea of an eternal Buddha have been when it emerged? What stage of development would the Trikaya doctrine have reached at the time of the White Lotus Sutra? The distinction between the Rupakaya of the Buddha and the Dharmakaya occurs even in the Pali Canon, although the Theravada uses the term Dharmakaya rather literalistically. In their view, the Buddha is the Dharmakaya simply because he is the embodiment of all the teachings contained in the Tripitaka. So the concept of the Dharmakaya, as distinct from the Rupakaya, was part of general Buddhist teaching before the White Lotus Sutra. But it was the White Lotus Sutra which brought it into prominence and placed it at the centre of the teaching, showing how important it was to see that the Buddha was the Dharmakaya in the fullest sense, not just the Rupakaya. The development of the Trikaya doctrine seems to have emerged in later Mahayana sutras. The early ones distinguish between the Rupakaya and the Dharmakaya, but make no mention of a Sambhogakaya. Sometimes what came to be called the Sambhogakaya shades into the Dharmakaya, but there is no sharp differentiation between them as they came later to be in the Trikaya doctrine, which is associated with the Yogacara. Question. In the White Lotus Sutra, it is almost as if the eternal Buddha is both Sambhogakaya and Dharmakaya. Answer. Yes, if the Buddha is to be an actor in a drama of cosmic enlightenment, he has to have a form. He can hardly appear as a featureless Dharmakaya. In that way, the Buddha has a Sambhogakaya-type presentation, though, in fact, he is the Dharmakaya. Perhaps it is not advisable to distinguish too sharply between the three kayas. Question. You suggest that the speaker of the sutra could be said to be the Anatta within. Could this mean that, in a sense, we have heard the White Lotus Sutra before because it is an innate memory? Answer. You could perhaps consider it in terms of the Platonic doctrine of reminiscence or the doctrine of mutual interpenetration. It is perhaps not too far-fetched to say that there is within you a level of receptivity on which you are listening to the truth represented by the sutra. Question. The corollary is that the Buddha is teaching within one's own mind. Given your reservations about any suggestion that one is already a Buddha, is this a useful image? Answer. I think it can be, if you bear in mind the limitations of that static way of looking at things. I think such phrases as the enlightened mind within are to be avoided because they are misleading if they are taken literally. A human being is a potential Buddha in the sense that if he or she makes a sufficient effort, he or she can attain enlightenment. But it is not as if there is just a thin layer separating you from Buddhahood, so that you have just got to get through that layer and, hey presto, there you are, enlightened. It is a big mistake to think of imminent Buddhahood as any kind of possession. As far as we know, the Buddha himself did not use the language of potentiality or imminence, and I am very doubtful as to whether it is a skillful language for us to use. No doubt it does express the actual spiritual experience at a certain level, but anyone who is not very spiritually advanced is likely to misunderstand, and would be better off hearing that by making sufficient effort they can eventually attain a state called enlightenment. We are all potentially enlightened, but that is not to say that we are literally enlightened at this moment in any sense that is comprehensible to us. Question. The idea of the Ananda within struck a chord with me. I wonder if identifying with Ananda rather than with the Buddha gets the benefits of the language of potentiality without some of the risks? Answer. Ananda is a much more modest figure because at the time of his association with the Buddha he was only a stream entrant, not yet fully enlightened. So yes, perhaps you can much more safely identify with Ananda. Question. Where did the language of potentiality come from? Answer. It is used in India outside Buddhism. In a way, it is the language of the Upanishads. One Upanishad says, I am Brahman, I am the Absolute. There is that direct identification. But whether the Upanishads had a historical influence on the Mahayana, it is difficult to say. It could be that the language of Buddhism was influenced by the thought of the Upanishads, or it could be that there was a parallel development. Question. The sutra speaks of three vehicles culminating in one Buddha vehicle. Is this principle of progressive levels unique to this sutra, or is it found in earlier teachings? Answer. It is not really so much a question of levels as of jhanas. What are thought of as different ways with different goals all merge into one way. They can perhaps be regarded as successive stages of one path, but the point is that it is one path. All these apparently different paths are reduced to one path. This is one of the two distinctive teachings of the White Lotus Sutra, which afterwards became the heritage of the whole of the Mahayana. At the time of the Buddha, there was only one path, but in the period before the rise of the White Lotus Sutra, the distinction between the Arhat and the Buddha had hardened into separate paths. The White Lotus Sutra was an expression of a reaction against this separation and effectively brought the paths back together again. In our own day, we are doing something similar on a certain level in the way we bring together the lay and the monastic, which had become so widely separated, into one going for refuge. Question. You mentioned that the Hinayana Nirvana is simply the eradication of the passions. Would it really be possible to eradicate all passions without developing insight? No, I don't think so. Even if you were to think just in terms of eradicating the passions and had no thought of gaining Bodhi, the attainment of Bodhi would still be part of the process of eradicating the passions, although your mode of expressing that experience will be limited. There is no doubt, however, that when in the Pali Canon Sariputra is asked to say what Nibbana is, he gives a purely negative definition, saying simply that it is the cessation of lobha, dosa, and moha. But there are other passages in the Pali Canon which tell a different story. In fact, the path to Nirvana, in whatever formulation, always has both a positive aspect and a negative aspect. In the intermediate stages there is a cessation of something unskillful, and also a coming into existence and increase of something skillful. As you progress up the spiral path, the positive and the skillful gradually increase as they counterbalance the negative and unskillful. By extension from that, Nirvana is certainly the cessation of everything unskillful, but it is also the plenitude of everything skillful. The Hinayana often left out the second part of the statement. Question: why should they have done that if they had genuine spiritual attainments? Would it have been some sort of skillful means? Answer: that's a circular argument, because you are assuming that they had some genuine spiritual attainment, when perhaps they did not. Perhaps there had been a deterioration, and on that account they thought just in negative terms. We know so little about the general historical situation, the cultural and social conditions, that it is very difficult to speculate. The fact is that the Theravadins presented the Dharma in increasingly negative terms, to the neglect, right down to the present day, of much more positive formulations, which are to be found in the Pali Canon itself. A classic example is that of the 12 positive Nidanas, which were completely ignored in expositions of the Dharma until the time of Mrs. Rhys Davids. Another case is that of the Iti Vitaka, which tails off at the end into an increasingly negative presentation of the spiritual life, the latter sections being apparently later productions. It is obvious that this tendency to negativity happened, but we are completely in the dark about the psychological, spiritual, and cultural reasons as to why it happened. Question: at the beginning of the sutra, 5,000 disciples walk out, and the assembly is thus purified. Why didn't the Buddha just preach to the whole assembly, contacting those who were receptive and not contacting those who were not? Answer: you have to consider what this sutra is trying to do. It is a drama, and in a drama there has to be action. I think the author of the sutra wanted to dramatize the disciples' rejection of the truth offered to them, to emphasize that this is what can happen. You can be so full of your own imagined spiritual attainments that you even close your ears to what the Buddha has to say and walk out. As a human being, you have that freedom, and some people, unfortunately, exercise it. This is the point that is being emphasized. Question: might the incident also indicate an awareness on the part of the Buddha that it is harder to teach an audience which includes people who are not receptive? Answer: yes, the fact that there are certain people present who are resistant does affect the atmosphere of a whole group. If you are speaking to a group, it is impossible to ignore a section of it which is in disagreement with the rest of the group. If most of an audience is very attentive and one section is restless, that interferes with the total empathy between speaker and audience. Question: the Buddha predicts to enlightenment arhats such as Shariputra, numerous bhikshus, bhikshunis like Mahaprajapati and Yashodhara, evildoers such as Devadatta, and non-human beings such as a Naga princess, but no lay people. Why is this, and could it be the reason for the emphasis on lay people in the Vimalakirti Nidesha? Answer: you would have thought that in view of the universalism of the Mahayana, that laymen and laywomen would also be predicted to enlightenment, so it is a rather odd omission. Perhaps, you could say, the Vimalakirti Nidesha makes up for that, although it would not have done so in a conscious way. Perhaps particular Mahayana sutras do have responsibility for particular approaches or emphasis. I'm sure that the sutra does not intend deliberately to exclude lay people. It is one of the earlier Mahayana sutras, so perhaps there is still an overemphasis on monasticism carried over from the Hinayana, which has not been fully permeated by the Mahayana spirit. As though the author has not completely transcended his Hinayana background. It is not so easy to bring everything that you have inherited from the past into line with your real position. Question. The body of the Buddha, Abundant Treasures, can only be revealed when all the Buddhas who have emanated from Shakyamuni are present. What is the meaning of this episode? And are the emanations people who have become Buddhas as disciples of Shakyamuni, or are they magical emanations? Answer. This coming together of the ancient Buddha and the present Buddha represents enlightenment's transcendence of time. The coming together of Buddhas, which are magical emanations, to answer your question, is the corresponding transcendence of space. The significance of the episode is that time and space are beginning to be transcended. Question. When Shakyamuni purifies the whole world and it turns into lapis lazuli with ground with golden cords, have we gone up to an even higher level to enter a sort of Sukhavati? Answer. It is more a question of feeling than doctrine. As you read the sutra, what do you feel? Do you feel as though you are rising to a higher level? Later on, there is that episode where the Buddha literally raises the whole assembly to a higher level, and the symbolism is obvious. But as you go through the sutra, you must be mindful and examine your own responses. Do you feel uplifted by a certain passage? Does it seem to raise you to a higher level of experience? You must consult your own experience.